This is an art. It takes time to finesse this and learn this and become an expert. And for me personally, it took, I think, many years to really get to the point where I truly felt comfortable assessing a patient's volume status consistently at the bedside. And it can be humbling at times.
You're listening to Parallax from Radcliffe Cardiology in association with MakeADent.org. Here is your host, Ankur Kalra, MD.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Parallax. This episode is supported by Zoll
and is intended for healthcare professionals.
So with that preamble, I have with me in this episode, Dr. Andrew Darlington, who is an advanced heart failure and transplant cardiologist at Piedmont in Atlanta, Georgia. I think Andrew and I are going to talk about a topic which is fairly nuanced for the clinician at the bedside, for clinicians taking care of patients in the office, any setting, intensive care unit, a telemetry bed in the hospital or in the office. I think volume status becomes crucial to assess in our patient population, particularly in patients with, advanced heart failure, who may be candidates for advanced therapies, including cardiac transplantation. So our topic of discussion is assessing volume status. And for that discussion, I have with me Dr. Darlington. Andrew, thank you so much for doing this for us. And welcome to Parallax.
Great. Thank you so much for that kind introduction. And it's great to be here.
Excellent. So we're going to just dive right in because this is a fairly nuanced topic. And you'll help us parse through some of the clinical details on physical exam that you key in to assess volume status, in your patients. Let me start by asking you as to why do you think this is still important, physical exam and volume status and assessing volume status by the bedside or in the office accurately is still of relevance or is important in 2024 when we have a plethora of diagnostic tools and bells and whistles, now also with the advent of augmented intelligence, as I like to call it, and not artificial intelligence. Why do you think this unique skill set that a clinician possesses is relevant still in 2024?
Yeah, I mean, it's a fantastic question. And bottom line, this is still relevant in 2024. For myself as a clinician, particularly a heart failure clinician, our history and physical exam of our patients is centered in on an excellent physical exam to start. And assessing volume status is the core measure that we look at for our patients with heart failure. And I think if ultimately a mistake is made in assessing volume status, the ramifications can be great. Errors in volume assessment can lead to changes in management and adverse outcomes if the volume assessment is done inaccurately. And these are tools that we are armed with from the very beginning, right? From medical school through residency and fellowship, we hone our skills at the bedside so that we can apply this over a career lifetime. And this is an art. It takes time to finesse this and learn this and become an expert. And for me personally, it took, I think, many years to really get to the point where I truly felt comfortable assessing a patient's volume status consistently at the bedside. And it can be humbling at times. We think we have a good grasp on a patient's volume status, and then we, proceed with hemodynamic assessments and the cath lab and find out that, our exam was inaccurate. So, but that being said, this is still very relevant in 2024 and paramount to our approach to patients with heart failure.
Yes. And so, when you see a patient in clinic or when you're seeing a patient, as a consult at the bedside in the hospital, how do you go about certainly history. Why don't we start with history first? What are some of the leading questions you may ask a patient in trying to garner all the information you require to get to the physical exam before you make a determination of the volume status?
Obviously, a very relevant question. It does start with the history, and it's remarkable how much you can glean from a patient's volume status just based on asking the right questions. So for me, it starts with simply asking about dyspnea on exertion. I think that has perhaps the highest sensitivity to be assessing circulatory congestion. So we start with that. And then from there, we expand. I think assessing symptoms at nighttime by means of paroxysmal nocturnal dyspnea, the presence of orthopnea, these are all very, very relevant. And we actually as well will ask about changes in dyspnea when patients bend at the waist, a term that we call bendopnea, all of which are designed to assess for a patient's intravascular filling pressure elevation. And with this, I think we ultimately can get a better sense as to where they are standing from a volume perspective.
Yes, I'm actually glad that you mentioned bendopnea. It's fascinating to me how much I've uncovered ever since I've learned that term, that bendopnea is actually a very relevant symptom in our patients. And, you know, they may at times will not provide you with history of paroxysmal nocturnal dyspnea or even orthopnea, but they will absolutely say yes to bendopnea. And then you are sort of... you know, committed to discerning more, you know, based on history.
Correct. 100%. And certainly, you know, the history isn't 100% sensitive, but it's easy to do. Everyone is equipped with the knowledge of asking the right questions and can be done in every one of our patients at the bedside.
Yeah. So, you know, once you've discerned, you know, New York Heart Association classification, you know, symptoms and presence of orthopnea, and paroxysmal nocturnal dyspnea, bendopnea. What is your approach to physical exam in assessing volume status in these patients?
Another very relevant question. And I'm fairly methodical with the way I approach my physical exam in patients with heart failure in an effort to uncover whether or not filling pressures are elevated. But ultimately, there's a number of different clues, if you may, physical exam clues that can, you know, tee us up for the potential filling pressure elevation that we see. Some of them in particular, when it comes to the exam, the presence of a third hard sound has, I think, tremendous specificity, perhaps not sensitivity, but specificity. But we look for this. The presence of rails on exam can be helpful when it's present, though not 100% sensitive either. Of course, the simple presence of edema, though once again, not specific. When it's there, it's noted. But to me, by far, the most accurate way to assess elevation and filling pressure is by looking at neck veins, right? This is something that we have been taught once again in medical school and again in residency and for me in fellowship. And there is truly an art to learning this. I think it took many years for me to be comfortable with this, but it's very important because I do feel, and most of us do feel, that this is probably the most accurate way to assess filling pressures, albeit on the right side. But we know that elevated filling pressures on the right side correlate very nicely without elevated filling pressures on the left. So if there's one physical exam tool that needs to be done on every patient, it's assessing neck veins by far.
Absolutely. And, you know, Andrew, I want to ask here, is there a particular position that you want to put the patient in before you start assessing for, you know, neck veins? And ask you why I'm asking this question. It is my understanding that at times it could be that elevated that if, you know, you may probably, it's probably that the column is that high that it could be all the way into this, you know, into the skull or scalp. So if you were to sit the patient upright, you may actually start appreciating them vis-a-vis, you know, having them sit in a tilted position at 45 degree angle. I'm going to have you talk through us because I do think this is crucial for the listenership.
Yeah, I'm glad that you brought that up because this is something that I teach again and again at the bedside with students and even colleagues. But for many of our patients, sitting the patient initially at 45 to 60 degree angle can work, and you can appreciate the tip of the pulse. But in all reality, it, just like what you described, in that scenario where the filling pressures may be so high that you may not appreciate it in the field of view at 45 to 60 degrees. So starting there, that is just a starting point for many, many patients. So if I can't appreciate it and I look on both sides, right and left, then we change the angle of the bed. You know, we may increase the angle for those patients that are dry. Actually, we may decrease the angle for some of these folks with the pressures are so high, you know, right atrial pressures, you know, above 20. We may even have our patients stand if they're able to at the bedside and appreciate the neck veins drop into the field of view when previously we weren't able to determine that. This is worth the extra couple of minutes to do because, once again, this is the difference between treating maybe and not treating your patients aggressively. And unfortunately, too often this gets missed and we have an inaccurate assessment of volume. And ultimately, therapy is not given when it should. And this has clinical ramifications for our patients, particularly when it comes to driving down rehospitalizations. An accurate assessment of volume is critical.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree with you more. So after you've assessed for the neck veins, what is your next step in the physical exam? Or, you know, I think we probably should get the transthoracic echocardiogram here into discussion as well, because, you know, it's sort of the extended physical exam, you know, particularly with diastology, which is, you know, available at our dispense and provides just crucial information.
Yes, absolutely. 100%. So once we move beyond the exam, you know, we do use our supporting technologies to help us, you know, assess filling pressures and elevations therein. So you mentioned echo, and echo is very relevant here. A well-performed echo when looking at diastology can be incredibly helpful in contributing to making a diagnosis. And the assessment of diastolic dysfunction on echo is, you know, part of our diagnostic strategy in patients with heart failure, particularly heart failure with preserved ejection fraction. These are a very nebulous group of patients, and the exam can be very limited sometimes. So assessing diastology on echo is critical here. So it has to be part of the comprehensive approach to patients when you're trying to make a not only a diagnosis but an assessment of volume status.
Yes, and so when you are looking at the echocardiogram, you know, at the bedside for these patients, Andrew, particularly, I'm gonna have you hone in on some of the diastolic parameters that you want to, you know, unequivocally account for to corroborate your clinical suspicion based on history and physical exam. What are some of the key diastolic parameters that you're looking into here when you are reading the echocardiograms for these patients?
I think it starts and ends with the mitral inflow velocities.
Yes.
On Doppler. Mm-hmm. I think you have to have good windows and good assessment to be able to determine what these values actually are. This is built in to our diagnostic assessment for patients with heart failure, particularly preserved EF. So getting good mitral inflow velocity on Doppler is critical so we can get that E and A waves and measure that in appropriate fashion. So we can get the grade of diastolic dysfunction and ultimately the assessment for filling pressures. So when we're comparing that alongside of our tissue Doppler. So these are very, very relevant. We try to spend a lot of time with our techs to make sure we're getting accurate assessment from this perspective. But I think that's probably the most important aspect of the echo when we're looking to assess diastolic dysfunction.
Yes. Yeah, so, you know, now you have a patient with, let's discuss a clinical scenario here, which I think could be helpful for the listenership to discern some of the, you know, conundrums in physical exam and some of the conundrums in echocardiography. You have a patient with, I would say, your column, your jugular venous pressure column is around 10 centimeters of water. There are rods on physical exam. There is somewhat of a peripheral edema. You are suspecting that the patient has, is not normovolemic, is hypervolemic intravascularly. And the echocardiogram is showing you a restrictive pattern on Doppler, ENA waves. In terms of clinical decision-making then, are you fairly confident to start aggressive intravenous diuresis in this patient?
I think the scenario that you are discussing here that shows a combination of elevated bilirubin pressures on exam and correlation with echo, I think it's enough to consider diuresis. I think with the restrictive pattern, obviously there has to be some caution that we display here, because some of these restrictive patients with restrictive cardiomyopathy, particularly infiltrative patients, when we tend to diurese them aggressively, we can end up in trouble, right? We drop their filling pressures very rapidly with aggressive diuresis, and that can lead us into a bit of a pitfall. So though this is all very helpful, we have to proceed with caution for patients with restrictive physiology, but still very relevant to be able to get the diastolic assessment on echo and correlate that with the physical exam.
Yes, so for patients with, I think this is a good, this is going to be a learning point for me here. For patients with reduced ejection fraction, compared with patients with preserved ejection fraction, is there a different strategy you deploy when you're diuresing these patients? Because both can present with acute decompensated heart failure. Is there a difference in diuresis strategy that you usually deploy in clinical practice?
Yeah. So I think the similarities first are, of course, volume removal. That is more or less the same between phenotypes, if you may. There are some probable subtle differences that we may look at with patients with legitimate preserved ejection fraction. So, I mean, by definition, these are patients technically with an ejection fraction north of 50. So some of these folks, it's particularly if they're coming in hypertensive, they have high afterload, we may focus a little bit more on afterload reduction for those with preserved ejection fraction. But quite often, the approach to diuresis and volume decongestion, if you may, can be similar. A lot of these folks respond very, very well to loop diuretic plus or minus thiazides. A lot of similarities there, but potentially with some of these folks, we'll pay a little more attention to the afterload and focus on that. So see that a little bit more in those with preserved EF.
Yes. Yeah, so, I think moving from a patient who is in florid heart failure, acute decompensated heart failure based on the history, the physical exam, and the echo Doppler findings we just discussed, just moving a step backward in the natural progression of, disease in these patients or in this subset, is there a method now in contemporary clinical practice in 2024, which can allow us to intervene sooner before our patients get to that point that we just discussed?
That's a great question to bring up, actually. We've spent a good bit of time chatting about the benefit of a solid history and physical exam. But at the end of the day, the presence and of symptoms and signs, congestion, volume overload, shortness of breath, all of these things, they're fairly insensitive, and they occur at the tail end of the pathophysiology of congestion and that timeline. And how often do we see when these patients will call the office and they'll say, hey, doc, I'm short of breath. It started yesterday. I've just noted some edema. And by the time we call them back, they're in the emergency room. So we've kind of got them at the tail end. And that's the drawback of using just signs and symptoms to guide management, when in all reality, there are metrics that we can look at well in advance of that, sometimes days, if not weeks, before we actually see a creation of symptoms and weight changes and things like that. And that's kind of looking at things along the lines of such as intrathoracic impedance changes, even filling pressure increases. And these particular two metrics, we may see up to 2 to 3 weeks before a patient is even hospitalized. So there is absolutely an avenue with which to look earlier on in this this timeline of congestion.
Yeah. So, for the listeners, Andrew, can you educate us about what is thoracic impedance? What do you mean by thoracic impedance? How does it add to your clinical knowledge of congestion?
Great question again. So I think when we're talking about measuring thoracic impedance, we're looking at a technology that measures lung congestion. Congestion of lung tissue is the target here. Thoracic impedance is the tool to measure that congestion. And the basis of it is really assessing congestion and water as a conductor. And we know that water is an excellent electrical conductor, typically yields low impedance values, unlike air in the lungs, per se, which is a very poor conductor and has high impedance. And we can do that. We can measure that impedance and use that as a surrogate for assessing lung congestion and water in patients with heart failure. And this is a technology that's been looked at now, really for years. And I think we continue to fine tune this technology and harness it and figure out how we can best use it to manage our patients with heart failure.
Yes. Yeah, so let's dive into some of the technologies that are available commercially with validated algorithms for assessing thoracic impedance, and which are the ones that you use in clinical practice, and based on the ones that you use, how do you then determine intervention, medical intervention or hospital admission, or considering them for non-invasive monitoring using a device like, CardioMEMS, for example?
Yeah. So there are a couple of devices that we'll look at when we're specifically interested in assessing impedance values. If you look historically, look no further than the information that we have embedded in our cardiac devices. As you probably know, many of our device-based therapies have algorithms built into them. These algorithms look at multiple different metrics, but some of them will look at thoracic fluid and impedance as one of them to help guide management. And it makes sense, right? I mean, we have devices with an electrode and a canister, and between that, you can measure impedance, the lung tissue, at least a portion of the lung tissue in between. So ultimately, one way that we'll do this is simply in the devices that we already have, and we can obtain that information very easily. Now, the drawback of this is that it can only be utilized in patients that have implanted devices. So there's obviously some inherent limitations with that particular technology, but when we have it, we do use it. Some of the other particular technologies that measure lung congestion as well, more recently, and perhaps we'll talk a little bit more about this in a bit, is using patch-based technology. The Heart Failure Management System, the Heart Failure Arrhythmia Management System, that basically uses the same technology by means of a radio frequency sensor that is placed on the skin surface and measures thoracic fluid index using radio frequency energy.
Yeah, actually, that's a great segue to talk about this particular technology. Do you want to just dive right in?
Yeah, let's do it.
So you said it's a patch-based technology. So these patients see you in the clinic, and based on maybe the number of readmissions they've had or the inability of the heart failure team to keep them out of the hospital leads you to explore more options so that you can, quote-unquote, catch them early before they do get admitted with congestion. I think the only way to do that is to somehow know that the intravascular volume status is gradually increasing, right? And you need to escalate diuretic therapy. So now you have identified these patients and you want to prescribe them this technology. How do you go about it? I mean, how do you explain it to them? You know, what is it that they're going to get in the form of a device? And how does the monitoring look? And what do you tell them to look for or signal the team whenever they look for a few signs?
Yeah, that's a very, very relevant question. So our interactions with the patients when we have identified them typically are occurring in the hospital. These are patients with worsening heart failure. And I think that's important to note that patient identification is critical here. We want to make sure we're identifying patients that are going to benefit from the system. So patients that have, of course, decompensated and ended up in an ER or hospital or even required IV diuretic in our clinics. Those are worsening patients. So once we've identified them, then we approach them. And it starts with a face-to-face conversation. I actually typically carry the HFAMS device in my hand. I have one in my hand right now. But we show it to the patient. And basically, as I mentioned to you earlier, it is a patch-based technology. So this is not implanted. And it's essentially worn on the axilla, the left axilla. And from this particular monitor, we can measure continuously thoracic fluid index across the chest wall. So it is a continuous accruement of data that we will receive. And what I tell the patients is it's simply a technology that's meant to be worn. And that data, as long as they wear, that data is being accrued and collected and stored. So we can ultimately view that on our end as the providers with the hope that we will make interventions where deemed necessary. So the involvement of the patient is fairly minimal, which I think helps when it comes to compliance with the technology itself.
Yes. Yeah, so, you know, a couple key points here, you know, for me, who's listening and learning more about this technology. One, it is truly non-invasive. We are not puncturing the skin. We are not deploying a device inside the patient's body. There is no lead. There is no permanent device which is being left inside the patient's body. So that's one. And two, it sort of is literally like a sticker, right? It's a sticker that sticks onto the chest wall. And then that's it. So, and then is there like an activation device that the patients have to use to sort of activate that patch so that they can transmit whatever has been recorded?
Yes, there is a handheld gateway. It's about the size of a standard cell phone, which is a chargeable technology and needs to be within about 30 feet of the patient and the device in order to transmit to the actual remote system that is collecting all this. So, but the actual involvement from the patient with this handheld device is minimal. Simply one button that they can push to transmit if they're symptomatic. But even with them not pushing any buttons, et cetera, the device is still interacting with our data collection system, and we're getting those values even without the patient touching anything. As long as that gateway is within 30 feet, we're getting that data. So it really makes things very easy for the patient. And I think adherence rates are great as a result.
Yeah. Now, is the patch something that requires charging, or is it battery operated? How does the patch?
Yes, it is a chargeable unit. So not only the gateway, but also the actual unit itself has to be charged typically every 5 to 7 days. And that comes with a cradle that charges both units simultaneously, really. And that can be done in any standard outlet. So it needs to be charged before first use. And then typically, like I said, every 5 to 7 days or so during the wear time.
Excellent. So, you know, maybe you want to discuss the BMAD trial, if I'm saying this correctly, the BMAD trial, which was presented at the ACC last year, now in 2023. I think that would be of relevance, you know, given what we've discussed so far.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and this was presented at ACC in the spring of last year. I think this was a very important study. It allowed us to hopefully better answer the utility of this particular technology in patients with heart failure. But just to go over this briefly, it was a multi-center, multinational prospective concurrent control trial. And this particular trial had two arms. And the arms were labeled as the control arm, which was the BMAD HF arm. And this particular arm itself, the patients wore the device. Information was accrued, but that information was not shared with the study investigators. So they were blinded to that particular data. Follow-up was the same, but ultimately the data wasn't shared with the investigators. The second arm was the actual intervention arm. That was considered the BMAD treatment arm. And these particular patients had the device. Information was shared, though, freely with the investigators. So those were the two clinical arms. They did not run simultaneously. The BMAD HF, or the control arm, started first. So I think that's an important part of this trial that needs to be stated, is that this was not randomized. So ultimately, this was a concurrent control trial. But ultimately, the endpoint was a comparison between the two arms looking at events, specifically time to first event being a heart failure hospitalization. So that was our primary endpoint. There were secondary endpoints as well, looking at mortality and quality of life. But ultimately, the primary endpoint was time to that first heart failure hospitalization. And the patients that were included were sicker. These were patients that had worsening heart failure. They were all enrolled very recently after a hospitalization for heart failure. And each of these patients had an additional heart failure event in the prior 6 months as well. That could have been another hospitalization, an ER visit, even an unplanned trip to the heart failure center for IV diuretic. So the other important thing is that there was absolutely no ejection fraction criteria. So this was a nice distribution of patients with preserved, mildly reduced, and overtly reduced ejection fractions. And the actual procedures themselves, both arms received the device. One arm, of course, once again, was control. The investigators did not receive that data. The other was the ultimate intervention arm. Then they did. And the standard follow-up timeline after enrollment consisted of numerous phone calls, as well as office visits with both arms. And then data was collected, including that quality of life information that I talked about. So ultimately, though, at the end of this, the endpoint was very favorable with patients in the intervention arm. When we looked at the time to first event for heart failure hospitalization, there was a 38% relative risk reduction in that event. Looking at that a little differently, there was a 7% absolute risk reduction, which gave us a number needed to treat of just 14 patients that needed to be treated to, you know, reduce one heart failure hospitalization. And I mean, you know, as well as I, that's a very favorable number when it comes to NNT. And all of the subgroup analysis that was done was very positive as well in favor of the use of the device. Furthermore, when we looked at the composite of heart failure hospitalizations, ER visits, and death together, once again, a 38% relative risk reduction was observed. And then finally, looking at changes in quality of life, and we looked at the standard Kansas City Cardiomyopathy Questionnaire to determine this. And when compared between the standard intervention arm and the control, there was improvement in quality of life as assessed by the KCCQ, showing benefit in terms of quality of life for patients wearing the device with active intervention. So it was a positive study at the end of the day. So I think this ultimately is a very positive thing for us. And, you know, I think this has led to more encouragement in utilizing this particular technology.
Yeah. So, Andrew, has this become a part of your clinical practice now?
Yes, it really has, particularly for those patients, once again, that are selected as worsening heart failure. So the bulk of the folks that we enroll in our clinic to follow with this technology have been recruited out of their hospitalization for heart failure. So quite commonly, we will approach them in the hospital and get them approved for it, and actually even wearing it on the way out the door from the actual heart failure hospitalization week, so we can start monitoring them immediately.
Yeah, no, this is excellent. Is there, this may not be a relevant question here, so, you know, pardon my ignorance. Is this of any utility in patients who have left ventricular assist devices?
So that's actually a really important question, because the patients with left ventricular assist devices were excluded from the BMAD trial. So we don't have data there. That's essentially a data-free zone. So we have not to date utilized this particular technology in those patients. I will also mention the additional exclusion criteria. People with subcutaneous ICDs were excluded, as well as those with WCDs, so wearable cardiac defibrillators. So those particular three groups were all excluded from the trial itself. So don't have data on that end.
Yeah, no, I learned a lot. So thank you for, delving into this technology and explaining it to us in great detail, particularly, you know, how sort of the day-to-day with this device looks like for patients and, you know, even for, you know, providers in a heart failure clinic. This has been a fascinating discussion, Andrew. Thank you so much for your time and, you know, for doing this for us. Any closing remarks for listeners at Parallax, you know, the vast majority of who, you know, cardiologists, advanced practice providers, trainees, medical students, residents, and fellows, early career?
Yeah. I think my closing remarks, the highlights are once again, the most important aspect of assessing congestion is assessing the patient. Please remember how important it is to go through a very accurate physical exam and a history. And in some of those patients, ultimately, where the physical exam is limiting, particularly those patients with high frequency of readmissions and worsening heart failure, utilizing remote monitoring technology using thoracic impedance can be extremely helpful. And we've found that the HFANS is an avenue for many of our patients to reduce readmissions and improve quality of life.
Excellent. Well, thank you. Thanks again for joining us. And, you know, for those of you who are listening, we welcome your feedback. Please share your feedback with us across all podcast platforms, including SoundCloud, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts. You can reach out to us, through the email address, which is mentioned in the show notes, or, drop us your comments in social media, the various social media platforms, X and LinkedIn. With that, thank you for listening, and we'll see you back another Monday. Take care.
We hope you enjoyed today's podcast produced by Radcliffe Cardiology in association with MakeADent.org. We aim to bring you a new angle of all things cardiology every second week. Review us on your favorite podcast app or send your comments or questions to podcast@radcliffe-group.com. To view the series, head to radcliffecardiology.com/podcasts/parallax. Thanks for listening.